It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Plenty to cover, as always. And starting out with, I guess it was, last week, right?
Friday night last week.
So it actually had already happened, and we just didn't know about it.
We weren't there, no. There was a police riot, and we missed out, no.
The police riot didn't happen in this case. It was actually a road rage incident at a Critical Mass event. Critical Mass is a group of bicyclists who get together the last Friday of every month to commute en masse during Friday rush hour traffic. Now, the intent differs according to who you talk to in any Critical Mass event. Some folks say it's a rolling party. Other folks say it's definitely a demonstration. We're making a point about how people need to get their butts out of their cars and onto a bicycle and get some exercise.
Well, and bicycle and safety in traffic also.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, and to emphasize that it is dangerous to ride a bicycle in Seattle, and it's more dangerous now than it's ever been, and that the city needs to make more provisions for bicyclists. So what happened at this last Friday event was it's up kind of up to who you talk to. Once again, the driver of the car, who police say was the definite victim, or the bicyclists involved in smashing up the driver's car and slashing his tires and beating him on the head after. Mind you, he hit a couple of bicyclists with his car. All I can say about it is anyone who has been to a demonstration knows that in every march, whether you're on foot or whether you're on a bicycle, there's always somebody in a car who is pissed off and trying to get where he wants to go, regardless of who is in his way. And there are always people in the demonstration who are going to get in his way and not let him go, even if he has to run them over with his car. In short, it takes two jerks on both sides to create a road rage incident, and I think that's what we had at this Critical Mass demonstration.
Yeah, and the really interesting thing about it has been the media coverage, where for whatever reason, our local media does not seem capable of the kind of, nuance that comes with the idea that one side might not be entirely blameless and the other side might not be entirely at fault. You have the daily papers and the TV stations, which basically took SPD's view of things, that the motorist was the hapless victim, and you had the stranger for whom, in their accounts of it, bicyclists can do no wrong. And, what actually happened probably isn't very accurately reflected by either of those perspectives, but that's how most people in this city learned about the incident, and it just didn't serve anybody very well.
Yeah, mind you, the police and the courts are the ones who are going to have the most impact on the people who took part in this event. And the police right now are favoring the driver when, in fact, by any measure, someone who is stepping on the gas in a vehicle around and hits people who are walking or who are riding a bicycle, that's assault with a deadly weapon, and the driver needs to be held responsible for that. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen.
All right. Well, moving on and continuing on the subject of transportation or transportation alternatives, let's start with the residential parking situation here in Seattle.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring this up. This was something that came out yesterday, that City Hall, among a number of initiatives to reduce car use that came out this week. There was also a car-free Sunday initiative that's going to be rolled out in a few neighborhoods this fall and potentially more in coming years. Is a program that one car per household will be all that gets residential parking permits in some areas where there's a real shortage of on-street parking right now. And that's particularly areas like Capitol Hill, Cascadia, the U District, etc. And in some other areas it will be two, and some other areas it will be four. And the media coverage of this pointed out something that is really pretty appalling, that in some cases up to seven different vehicles are being operated by each household. And that's a problem. It's a problem both in terms of people who do need to park, and of course the city also has an interest, particularly as it densifies, in reducing car use for environmental reasons and just for reasons of livability in the city. That being said, there's a real question here of coordination of policy for several reasons. A number of these neighborhoods that are the most dense and have the most problems with parking issues right now are the neighborhoods where you have houses that are being shared by a number of people, particularly the University District with a lot of students, Capitol Hill, which at least until recent years has been kind of a hipster district, etc. And you have several unrelated people sharing the same house in order to make ends meet because you simply cannot afford apartment costs on your own, particularly if you're young and not very well off, or just if you're not very well off, period, in Seattle. And so the residential parking proposal that came out would limit those households as well to one residential parking permit per house, which raises the issue for unrelated adults living in the same household, who gets to have the car? And it just seems like it's not very well thought out, and it doesn't, I suspect that people making the policy are kind of oblivious to the fact that that there are a lot of people in this city still who don't, either oblivious to the fact, or they don't particularly want to see continue the fact that there are people in this city who don't make $50,000 or even $30,000 a year, who are trying to get by even with the exorbitant rents in this city. That's one thing. The other thing is that if you're trying to discourage car use at this time, the way you do it is by increasing funding for public transit. We had another news item this week saying that Metro is ditching its effort to increase bus fares by 25 cents per ride for its basic fare this fall because it thinks it's going to need more than that. And the reason it needs more than that is it's not getting enough money from sales tax revenue because of the slowing economy. There's a coming budget shortfall for King County. And, you know, because of Tim Eymann's initiatives, because of the restrictive way in which we fund public transit in this state, we don't have the kind of funding for public transit that is necessary to give people who are at the lower end of the economic spectrum options that make it practical for some people to not have a car, you know, because that's what you're talking about, is not just getting out of your car and not driving it as often. It's not having any place to put it at all when you're talking about the parking permit. It just seems like, as is often the case with transportation planning and policy in this city, that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Yeah, and granted that some of these neighborhoods where the city is limiting the number of parking permits per household, these neighborhoods tend to have really good bus service. On the other hand, as Job mentioned, there's a shortfall at Metro. It's several million dollars, probably upwards around $80 million if you look at it for the two-year period that's coming up. And there's no easy way to make up that shortfall except to raise user fees, because the state has not stepped up to the plate to replace any funding source once Tim Eymann's I-695 took away the car tab tax. Well, and in addition, in these neighborhoods, the King County Council has said, well, you know, we got to look at everything when we're trying to balance the budget. And whereas we made a commitment before not to cut bus service, well, we can't say that we won't cut bus service in order to balance the budget now.
Even so, at a time when ridership is going through the roof.
Yeah, at a time when this week I had to stand at a bus stop and watch two full buses pass me by. I waited almost an hour to catch a bus. I mean, that's never happened in the city before in the 20 years that I've been riding Metro. I've been passed up by buses once and then been able to get the next one, but not been passed up by two buses in a row jam-packed with people. That's the situation we're looking at now as far as the expansion of ridership.
All right. And related to that, the county did a recent study on buses?
Well, no, actually it was the American Public Transportation Association, a national group that did a study of the cost savings if you ride the bus. What they found is that a U.S. resident, this is averaging over all of the United States, would save about $8,059 a year if they parked their car and took the bus instead. For a Seattle resident, that'd be a little higher because of the higher gas prices on the West Coast. You'd save $8,413 a year. That's if you ride the bus during off-peak times. If you ride it during peak times, you'd save about $8,300 a month, or $8,300 a year. if you ride it two zones, say if you live in the suburbs, you park your car or get rid of your car, even better, and you take the bus across the zone lines, you'd save still about $8,000 a year. It's a significant savings, and it's nice to see that somebody in this time of higher gas prices actually came out and did a cost study. Would have been nice to see it, you know, 5 or even 10 years ago when riding the bus wasn't such a popular thing and gas was still cheap, but at least they're doing it now.
Yeah, there was a really fatuous article in one of the local papers, I forget which one, about a month ago that was sort of one of these, does it really cost you money to ride the save you money to ride the bus? And
hello?
What it was you know, the cost of the gasoline you burn driving from, say, Edmonds to Seattle versus the cost of bus fare. And that is such a facile analysis when you take in all the different factors of how much it costs to operate a motor vehicle, just on a per-mile basis, let alone whether you own one at all or not,
yeah.
that I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have somebody come up with some more reality-based numbers.
Yeah, hello. Car payments, insurance, maintenance, you know, it's just the expense of having a car just goes on and on and on. And the more you use it, the more you pay.
Yeah, a good rule of thumb in the past has been 50 cents per mile between depreciation and operating costs for a car. And that was before gasoline prices went up. So it's expensive.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. We have an update from last week's story about the Big Pot Bust.
Yeah, folks were wondering why, even though the local prosecutors, this was the University District Medical Marijuana Club that was busted into by SPD about a week and a half ago, where they took not only all of the pot, but all of the medical records and left a nice big hole in the wall just as a calling card, why they hadn't returned the pot, even though under the state's medical marijuana law, they were required to do so. And, of course, they returned the medical records, but probably not until they made copies for their own personal use. But as it turns out now, they didn't turn it over because they were required to turn it over to the feds instead. And the interesting part about this was Assistant Prosecutor Jeffrey Sullivan, who was the lead in this case for the U.S. District Attorney's Office here in Western Washington, was put on the record a couple of years ago in an interview by Philip Dowdy in the Seattle Weekly, saying that this is something that the federal prosecutor's office in Western Washington was not concerned about in terms of its coordination with the state's medical marijuana law. Seizing pot was absolutely not a priority. It wasn't something they were going to do for grow clubs, and they were primarily concerned about distributors. As long as it wasn't being used for distribution, they didn't care. So apparently, somebody probably higher up the food chain, because we've seen this in other parts of the country as well, has overruled that policy, and we're seeing more of a concerted effort to target state medical marijuana laws, which is something that should alarm the people of Washington State.
All right, moving on to national, and one of the government's leading biodefense scientists who died on Tuesday.
Yeah, their lead researcher in developing a vaccine for anthrax, Bruce E. Ivins, a 62-year-old biomedical researcher at Fort Detrick, Maryland. He'd been actually working there for 35 years. He was the FBI was just on the point of arresting and charging him in the anthrax mailings. Folks might remember back to just post 9/11 in 2001, the anthrax mailing killed 5 people and sickened 17, and caused a major panic around the United States about terrorist attacks through the mail. Brucey Ivins, it turns out, was one of the guys who actually helped the FBI analyze the anthrax used in one of the attacks. He also was engaged in some suspicious activity at his own lab, including cleaning up anthrax and not telling anybody. Usually when there's a spill outside of a containment area of a controlled thing like anthrax, what researchers have to do is they fill out a report, they do cleanup, and they do follow-up. He didn't do any of the filling out reports or telling anybody. He just went ahead and did his own little cleanup there, which made him a very suspicious person in the case. But the FBI didn't follow up until 2006, when Robert Gates replaced the people who were in charge of the investigation. Then they started taking a look at Ivins.
Robert Mueller, I think.
Robert Mueller, I'm sorry. And this guy, you have to understand, had a history of making homicidal threats since the time he'd been a graduate student at university. So
which,
he should have been.
Which also raised the question about his security clearance to work on top secret bioweapons.
Exactly. So the FBI has and the U.S. military have a lot of explaining to do about how they run their background checks, how they do their security, and the FBI has a lot of explaining to do about the whole investigation in which they initially targeted Stephen Hatfill, and it turns out he was not the guy.
Yeah, I think those FBI background checks, they only check for if you're working with select agents, they only check if you have had a criminal history, with the government. Otherwise, they don't look for psychiatric history.
Or restraining orders or anything like that.
Yeah, even though these guys are dealing with extremely toxic substances.
All right, moving along. This week's police blotter.
Yeah, there was an awful lot of interesting news down at the courthouse this week. First of all, Ted Stevens, he of the Internet as a Series of Tubes, he himself went down the tubes this week, which was always nice to see, and couldn't have happened to a more deserving person. This is basically, as it turns out, probably the person that the FBI has been after, as they've slowly worked up their way up their food chain of corruption in Alaska State Republicans over the last several years, including relatives of Stevens, Republicans in the state legislature there, and of course Don Young, the representative from the state of Alaska, is also under investigation for several different things. He has resigned his seat this way as a ranking Republican in the Senate Commerce Committee, which is probably a good thing, since the Senate Commerce Committee actually does have jurisdiction over the Internet, and Mr. Stevens thinks it's a series of tubes. interesting story this week, speaking of the Senate, that came out a GAO report, and then also highlighted on the floor of the Senate by Senator Claire McCaskill, a Democrat from Missouri, that the Defense Contract Audit Agency, that's the audit arm of the Pentagon, is implicated in a really damning report that the GAO put out last week, saying that, among many other things, the DCAA was basically intimidated by or shut down from or actively conspired with military contractors to hide evidence of waste, of overspending, of performance problems in weapon systems. And surprise, surprise, one of the military contractors that was listed as being the source of some of the corruption of in the audit process, and that also tried to shut down and pressure the GAO investigation of the DCAA, was none other than Boeing, which is particularly interesting because no local media here in Seattle, at least not the daily papers and not the television stations, happened to mention this, which raises kind of an obvious question. Why is it when the Mariners run into problems, our local papers can be honest about it? When Boeing runs into problems, not so much. We also had Monica Goodling taking the fall for her former boss at the Department of Justice this week. The DOJ Inspector General and the Office of Professional Responsibility issuing a joint report this week saying that Goodling and a couple of other aides under former AG Alberto Gonzalez essentially broke a lot of laws and regulations, particularly what they called systematic abuses of the hiring of avowed conservatives, and not just any conservatives, but they had to be a particular kind of red meat conservatives. conservatives for civil service positions that are supposed to be politically neutral. That's a problem. Also, you had three different people, Monica Goodling being one of them, who were accused of lying to Congress. That is a crime. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Goodling was targeted for a lot of the blame on this. Goodling happens to be the one person in this this whole narrative of Attorneygate who is immune for prosecution, because she cut a deal with Congress whereby she would get immunity in exchange for her testimony. So it just happens to be a remarkable coincidence that she's now been being blamed for a lot of the problems of the Department of Justice, and Gonzalez, of course, saying that he had no idea, absolutely no idea, was completely shocked that any of this could have been going on in his watch, which, if you believe, there's a bridge somewhere that Mr. Gonzalez would like to sell you, and it's not in Texas. And then finally, we had the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, an outstanding environmental group that watchdogs government agencies, and especially the EPA, leaked some documents this week that the EPA last month instructed its staffers not to answer questions from congressional investigators, from the GAO, from anybody else who's investigating any number of issues that the EPA is under investigation for, particularly whether there was political interference in the decision not to allow California to regulate greenhouse gases. So expect more on that one coming up soon.
All right. That takes us over then to this week's economic news.
Yeah. There were two more bank failures over the weekend this past week. They were smaller regional banks, First National Bank of Nevada and First Heritage Bank of California. You'll notice that they're in parts of the country that have suffered the worst housing price falls in the housing crisis. Both banks were seized by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and currently the FDIC is working to sell those banks' assets to a larger regional bank, Mutual of Omaha Bank, which means, of course, we're going to see a lot of this smaller banks that got involved in the whole mortgage housing fiasco are going to be swallowed up by bigger banks. So we're going to see a lot more of this. This brings the total of bank failures this year to 7 so far, when I think we've had maybe 4 banks fail in the last 7 years, something like that. Meanwhile, Merrill Lynch, another massive investment bank, narrowly avoided a Bear Stearns-like collapse this week by holding a fire sale of its stock and some of its assets. They sold a bunch of their mortgage-backed securities for $6.7 billion, and that turned out to be about one-fifth of the value of those assets a year ago. And they sold them to a private equity firm called Lone Star. They also announced that they're going to sell about $8.5 billion in new stock, and this sale is going to dilute current shareholders of Merrill Lynch by about 38%. Now, that's a slippery slope there when you say, instead of being able to borrow money, we can't really borrow money to cover our debts and our cash payments. We're going to have to sell more stock. That's a slippery slope, because that could devalue the company even more, make it even harder for them to meet their debt commitment. So that's a mark of their desperation. So it's very possible that in the end they could need a bailout, just like Bear Stearns. We'll have to see. This week also, the IMF issued its global financial stability report, looking at the whole global economy, and it was pretty pessimistic about the global economy, primarily because of the U.S. housing market and the resulting credit crisis. The IMF, unlike happy talk politicians and economists here in the U.S., doesn't think we're at the bottom yet, doesn't think we're ready to turn a corner at all. They claim that, in their estimate, we're going to see $1 trillion in losses in the banking sector. So far, banks have only reported about $469 billion in losses since last August. So we're not even to the halfway point, much less ready to turn a corner. This week also, Big Oil announced its profits. The 6 largest oil companies in the world reported $51.5 billion in combined profits for the second quarter. That's just for the second quarter, not for the year. ExxonMobil in particular, well, let me just name them. ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, BP, short for British Petroleum, Royal Dutch Shell, and Total, which is a French company. The profit really if you look at ExxonMobil's report, they said their profit was made mostly on their upstream operations. That means the drilling and extraction of crude oil and natural gas. If you look at their downstream operations, though, refining and retailing, they actually took a loss, especially due to the price of gasoline in the U.S. Apparently, the price of gasoline in the U.S. is still too low. So I think we can see how gasoline prices are being subsidized here in the U.S. by the high cost of crude oil on the international market, and that there's room for gas prices to go higher, even though we've seen a little bit of slippage in the crude oil price this past week. It's not enough to make a difference.
All right. Moving on to international and starting with Afghanistan.
Yeah, several things going on in Afghanistan this week. Of course, the end of the month of July. We've mentioned the past couple months that there have been more deaths in Afghanistan than there have been in Iraq. Well, that changed in July. This month, there were nearly two times as many soldiers, U.S. soldiers, dying in Afghanistan that there were in Iraq. And it was also the first time that there were more overall soldier casualties in Afghanistan than there were in Iraq. Meantime, a report came out this week saying basically that we've been going in Afghanistan all wrong, that between 2005 and 2007, the U.S. Switched to a heavily into reliance on an air war in Afghanistan. They went from dropping 5,000 pounds of munition a month in early 2005 to 168,000 pounds of munitions per month in December of 2007. And civilian casualties, not surprisingly, have gone up in a similar fashion. In fact, even just in the last year, they're up 62%. And surprise, surprise, as those civilian casualties have increased in Afghanistan, support for the Taliban has been far greater, too. Now, the interesting part about this is that almost nobody is talking about the appropriateness of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, and that includes the anti-war movement. We had several things going on this week in the Puget Sound area. This week, there was more arrests, I think 9 people all told, down in Tacoma with another shipment through to Fort Lewis through the port there. We've got a couple of events today, one on Iraq, one on protests on Iran that we'll talk about when we get to events. But there's been almost nothing either in the local anti-war movement or more broadly in local political coverage or media coverage that really focuses on the war in Afghanistan. This is particularly problematic because most Americans are much less skeptical of that war than they are of the war in Iraq, even though our strategy has been equally flawed and disastrous in Afghanistan. It's probably just as unwinnable a war. And we have both Obama and McCain saying that they're going to shift the focus to Iran if they're elected president, and one of them certainly will be. So this is something we need to start paying a lot more attention to.
All right. Finally, Maria, about 30 seconds for the WTO talks that failed this week.
Yes, the WTO talks failed. They were trying to get the Doha round up and running again. This is probably the last chance they would have. And they failed because China and India held the line against the U.S. position that all barriers should come down regarding food shipments. And China and India basically said, no, we want to allow poorer nations the ability to protect themselves against an influx of cheap imported food in order to keep their farmers working on their farms and growing local food. This is called food security, you guys, in the U.S. Let us have some. And it's particularly important now that food prices are rising. And it's amazing how oblivious the U.S. negotiators were to this sensitive issue.
All right, and events.
Yeah, several anti-war things going on today, as I mentioned. 11 o'clock, there will be a vigil for Aaron Watada at Westlake. His case is starting to heat up again, that being the officer who refused deployment to Iraq and has been court-martialed, or attempted to be court-martialed twice by the Army now for his refusal. That'll be at Westlake Park in downtown Seattle. A few blocks away at noon, there will be a rally and march to oppose war military strike on Iran that will be convene at the federal courthouse at 7th and Stewart, and then go back to Westlake Park, which they'll presumably take an indirect route because that's only about four blocks. Also at noon, there will be a similar. This is part of a national quote unquote day of actions. There will be a similar rally against war with Iran that'll be held at the gates to Fort Lewis at exit 119 off of I-5 south of Tacoma. And then on Wednesday, it's the 63rd anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, and the country's largest annual commemoration of that bombing happens here in Seattle at Green Lake every year. Happened again this year in the evening with a lantern float and a program that starts around 6:30.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with news, information, comments, et cetera, et cetera. Our endorsement issue for the August 19th primary is coming up next week. So we'll probably be talking about that on this program in the next couple of weeks. And we're in the midst of a summer fun drive, too. So if you can help out with support for a all-volunteer community effort, we much appreciate that. You can find it where you find free publications and bookstores, cafes, library system, etc., or on the web at www.eatthestate.org. Or if you have questions, comments, tips, any of that kind of good stuff, email us. Our email is info@eatthestate.org.